I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, listeners. Since you can't come to the London Review Bookshop at the moment to enjoy our events, we're bringing them to you at home. While we're closed, our new podcast episodes will feature guests who you might, under better circumstances, have been listening to live in Bury Place, as well as previously unreleased gems from our archives. You can order the book discussed in this episode by visiting lrb.me/order. That's lrb.me/order.
Hi, my name is Mary Mount and I am a publisher at Viking Books, and I'm delighted to be talking today to Nikita Lalwani, best-selling author, prize-winning author, and this is her third novel. It's called You People, and it was described by Kamala Shamsi as an exceptional novel about the Britain we live in, even if we choose not to see it. You People was published earlier this month. I wanted to start off this conversation just talking about how you write about the city. This is one of the best books about London I've read in recent years. And specifically, as Kamala Shamsi put it, it's about the London we don't often see or look deeply at. Can you talk about what drew you to this world?
Well, I'm definitely interested in this idea of people living in the interstitial spaces of an iconic city like London. I remember reading the writer Mavis Gallant when I was writing the book at the start, and the short stories that she set in Paris, which have these holes cut through the fabric of Paris so that you can peer inside and see subcultures, configurations of class and belonging. I was interested in it mainly because the idea of being hidden is all dependent upon who's doing the looking. So people who are considered hidden, or people who a reader might otherwise not have chosen to know or understand, are not hidden to themselves. So the restaurant in the book is a place where anyone can go, and there's a kind of equality or parity of access. So anyone can attend the restaurant in the book and be seen, in a sense. And that idea I found exciting, this idea that there would be a place where you could go in a city like London and whether temporarily or for a little longer have a sense of belonging, whatever your background, nationality, class, or any other of the other markers of identity that you might normally have for a character in a book.
I mean, that's actually that I should sort of explain that the heart of the novel is a very ordinary pizzeria that's familiar to anybody on any high street in any city in Britain. But the interesting thing about it is that none of the chefs are Italian. They're all Sri Lankan, and the proprietor is this fantastic sort of Solomon type character called Tuli, who runs a restaurant and again is like the sort of proprietor you might see in any high street chain. But he has a very sort of peculiar or specific effect on his staff and also on the people passing by on the street. He's a very kind of morally awkward character in a way that I suppose all of us are in some ways, and has tremendous power. Do you want to talk about the idea of this man who is a kind of Robin Hood figure to the people working for him?
Yeah, I knew a character who was a bit like Julie, who who worked in a restaurant and who was very confident in his moral choices. And I found that really fascinating and quite inspiring. I think I came away from knowing him with this feeling that altruism, or the kind of altruism that he was interested in, was kind of contagious. So if you're around it, then you might be able to absorb it in some way. But also this idea that altruism and selfishness can be linked, and that that's okay, possibly, so long as the outcome is of use. So this utilitarian feel to what he was doing. So the character in the book, Julie, runs a kind of Solomon's court where people can come and tell their stories of need. And based on that, he would decide in the book whether or not a loan might be issued at 0%, 50%, or 100% interest, or be a gift with no need for return. So huge moral decisions being made here. And I found that very exciting in the person that I knew, because he had a lot of impact on the community around him near the restaurant where he was working. But I also was interested in it novelistically, because there's a lot of hubris in making decisions about who gets helped. So the idea of love thy neighbor is quite a big philosophical problem within that idea if there aren't enough resources to go around. So what is this preferential system of loving thy neighbor that someone like that is employing? And what is the hubris in that? What happens if you make a decision that goes wrong, as invariably any human being is capable of doing? And how does that unfold in a kind of thriller-like way, I guess, in the book?
Yeah, because it's very good the way you play with the reader in the book. There's a character in the novel who appeals to help from Thule, and he may or may not have hit his wife. And there are characters throughout who have these flaws, and you as the reader never know necessarily what they've done, in the same way that really you can never completely know in a court of law, or you can never never make a completely fail-safe judgment. And as a reader, I didn't know which way I would have gone, particularly in the case of that guy, because he desperately needed help. On the one hand, he was very much in need of help, and on the other hand, you felt, is it right to give him that help? And I suppose the novel is a lot of it is about judging and who gets to judge and who gets to be judged. And the title, some people have found the title quite kind of, what's the word, direct, the title of You People. And it plays in two different ways in the book. And I wondered what drew you to that title and why that title was so important to the sort of point of the book.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the idea of ambiguity around transgression with the character who's hit his wife. There are other characters in the book who have behaved in a way that some might deem correct and some might deem incorrect, that it's not a correct way to conduct yourself in a just society. And the idea of breaking the law is very important in the book. Is it okay to break the law if you're a government that's killing its own people? Is that breaking the law? Or is it breaking the law to help someone seek asylum in a certain way if it involves untruths, if the outcome is one of benefit? You People as a title is sort of linked to that, because it's a direct address for the reader. Initially, there's this idea of self and other. You know, who are the you people? Is the reader being othered, or is the reader involved? Is the reader saying it to the people in the book? But it's also a kind of transgression, that sort of intimacy. There's something really intimate in pointing the finger and saying you people. And in the book, you people is quite an affectionate term at the start. Don't you people do the following? And then it's a kind of hate speech towards the end when it resurfaces. So I like the blunt sort of imperative in the title, you people, and the fact that it was something that was turning over at the center of the machine of the book, really, as I was writing it. It's funny how you come up with a title. It wasn't the working title of the book. And then it was the title that emerged at the end, probably when the conundrum of the book was closer to being solved in my mind.
Yeah. It's interesting how you decided to set the novel not in the very immediate past, not in the kind of cauldron of Brexit, but was the kind of questions about judgment and who gets to be here and who gets to decide, and was that one of the, that whole idea of belonging, was the recent political situation, was that a prompt in the beginnings of this book?
Yeah, it's interesting, as I was writing it and the climate seemed to be changing and yet it was still the same and it still seemed to contain reverberations of that which has passed. I mean, if you look back to W.H. Auden's poem, Refugee Blues, say this city has 10 million souls, some are living in mansions, some are living in holes, yet there's no place for us, my dear, there's no place for us. In 1939, everything seemed to be a permutation of past as I was watching it unfold, and yet the book is set in a particular time to do with an influx of refugees from the Sri Lankan War in the early noughties is when it's set. So I think that London in the book is a very welcoming and also hostile place, that the two coexist. And the restaurant is also like that. So it can be a place where there are people who are legal EU immigrants and those who are not legal yet and hope to be legal, who are working in the kitchen in the back, who are from Sri Lanka. And there's a bleed through from front to back. But equally, it's hostile because the police turn up, there are immigration raids. There's a kind of cutthroat quality to survival on a street where there are so many different establishments, which establishment will get the customers. So I think for me, it feels like there's a lot of resonance by looking at the recent past and what we're going through right now.
Yeah, and I suppose it's that, as you say, it, you know, you can pick any period and see the resonance. You know, and obviously in great fiction, that's what great writers do. And I was wondering about, when I was reading the book and working on it with you, there's been lots of conversation. Well, there's always conversation about the whole idea about writing about real events and the difficulty of writing about very recent political events and indeed political trauma. And I was thinking about, obviously, there's a controversy about American Dirt, but I was thinking about that your first two novels. One is set in Cardiff about a young girl who was a maths prodigy, and the second one is about a documentary maker going to an open prison in India. But this is your most sort of immediately political and deals with very real, specifically real traumatic events of the Sri Lankan Civil War. I wonder what you felt about writing about war, recent war in fiction, and how, you know, whether you had trouble with that or how you dealt with transforming into a fictional landscape.
I think that in writing any book, especially one that contains trauma, that would be the sort of sharp edge of it. You're always wondering about how to get it right. And if you think about that for too long, it can ruin the book. And if you don't think about it enough, it can ruin the book. So certainly when I was looking into things like torture and talking to Freedom From Torture, the organization, I knew that my usual method of research, which would be, I come from a documentary background and I still use the same sort of intrusive voyeurism when writing, and that sort of up close obsession with detail that I would have when I was filming. Certainly, I knew that that wasn't going to work, because interviewing someone who's experienced torture will bring it back most likely in an experiential way. And so that idea of the ethics of writing a book in which there is trauma, as you put it, political trauma, personal trauma, there's a lot of physical trauma that is running in this contiguous way with the emotional trauma of the book. It's a very audacious thing to do. And if you think about putting yourself in someone else's shoes too much, you just can't do it. So I think that there's this balance in the different times of writing where you are sometimes writing without care, on purpose, and without much concern for ethics. And then it's important to stand back and look at what you've done. You can't just say, well, this just all poured out of me and I just sort of closed my eyes and that's what happened. You have to take responsibility for it. Writing is a political act, I think, whatever you're writing about, because especially when you reach the end of a book, something about authorial intention is usually revealed. So I think it's important to sort of stand up and take that into account and be responsible for it. So there's a mixture of research and imagination at play. But I think that it's important to do it. It's important to try and animate these stories so that we don't just have a certain kind of story being told about, for example, the immigrant or refugee experience, so that there are multiple stories at play.
You're listening to the London Review Bookshop podcast. You can order the book discussed in this episode by visiting lrb.me/order. That's lrb.me/order.
What I've found very interesting is a lot of fiction that I've encountered finds it very difficult to balance what can be described as kind of big events, sort of a terrible civil war, the suffering of an individual in that context, with what would seem to be smaller trauma or smaller experiences, which is individuals may suffer within a domestic environment. So you have this wonderful combination of characters in the heart of the novel. The two people who depend on the proprietor, on Tuli, are a young mixed-race Welsh girl called Nia and the Sri Lankan refugee Shan. Is it Shan or Shan? Shan.
Shan is how I would say it, but Shan is another way to say it too, yeah.
And I think what is interesting is how you pull off the idea that even though Nia is just fleeing a drunken hippie mother who's made her life an absolute car crash, but her experience is as compelling and as rich, if that's the right word, as Shan's experience is. And I think I wondered how difficult that was to do, because it could have been, it could have reflected very badly on Nia in a way.
Yeah, that's something that was interesting as I was writing it, because I didn't initially write it from two points of view. I first off started trying to write it from the Tuli point of view, the godfather or the godlike figure at the heart of the book. And then I realized very quickly that his mystery was being dissipated as I wrote, and I was writing it to understand him because I was in his head. So I split the narrative between Nia and Shan. And Nia, I think, very quickly realizes that her experience of struggle against economic hardship is not atypical and not linked to a racial or a cultural background setup. And I think that that started to emerge organically, really, as she turns up and becomes fascinated with Tuli and is engaged with him in a way that is a sort of romantic interest, but it's also a desire to be him, his sort of grandiose benevolence and the fact that he's actually having a positive impact on the world rather than looking within to what she calls the hidden pockets of the self. This idea of looking outward is very appealing for her. And juxtaposed with Shan, the Sri Lankan cook who's fleeing the war, juxtaposed with his concerns, he's constantly trying for a family reunion, trying to find his wife and his child. They have a lot in common in terms of trying to get a sense of family going, to coin a phrase, more in common.
Essentially, that's what really connects them. And there's a really brilliant scene where Nia's had a bit of a rough night and Shan cooks for her. And it's just such a touching scene where you realise that the two of them are just, they just want to find some solace and comfort. And in the end, what's terrific is in their own sort of very complicated way, they find it. When you're reading the novel, you just don't know how it's going to go. And there's a terrifying section when Shan is desperately trying to find his wife and child and find out whether they're still alive and where they are. And he makes these connections through terrible people in order to do so. And there's a very dramatic scene where you think he may well be reunited. So your sort of heart is in your mouth throughout most of the second half of the novel. And then you have the ending, and I won't give it away, but it is what I would describe as sort of tentatively optimistic. It's completely real, but there is a sense that these people are going to be okay. Thank God. Is that how you always saw it? And is that a sort of, do you think that's, not wishing to kind of psychoanalyze you, but do you think that's a sort of way in which you look upon generally this situation?
Yeah, I think you're right that the ending could have gone a number of different ways. And I think that endings are very important, as I was saying, that an ending can really make you think about the entire book in a different way. It can make you throw a book against the wall if an ending doesn't feel like it works with what you've read or the worldview of what you've read or the character progression. Or an act of God at the end of a book can often be infuriating. It has to emerge, I think, from something that makes sense in the universe of the book, even if there is an act of God. So I think for me, there is an optimism in the ending, even though it's not a neat ending and everyone isn't put back together again in this jigsaw of contentment. But there's an optimism in the idea of taking agency and the idea that we do have the power as people to connect and to change our fates. And that's why optimistic is right, because obviously sometimes there is so much that can function as a kind of manacle around our ability to have choices or to make decisions that any kind of movement is impossible. At the end of this book, there's the chance to reconcile certain problems, and other things will need work, and other things may or may not turn out how you want. But as Tooley says when he's confronted by Nia at the end, you know, I make mistakes, but is it better not to intervene? Is it better to just walk on by? Or is it better to intervene and get a lot of it right and sometimes make a mistake? That's, I guess, the conundrum that's still there at the end of the book. But this idea of being able to make a decision and being able to take steps within the confines of the universe that each character finds themselves in, but also the idea of personal responsibility,
yeah,
is there.
And I think there's that sense also, which obviously resonates very deeply right now, which is that sense of the connection between strangers in a city, that because everybody is right up against each other, that actually it's only really these connections, this sort of connected humanity that does get everybody through. And I wondered whether that was sort of that's definitely what is resonating with me from this book in this current situation, I think.
Yeah, you're right. We're seeing all kinds of connections happening in our proximity within immediate walkable distance right now. And that's very much what's happening in the book, that it's all about the square mile, yeah, around the restaurant. And the people you might meet in the laundrette, the people you might meet in the supermarket, in the betting place, in the pub, and all about their different needs, given their different backgrounds, and the kind of exuberance of that in a place like London, where you're confronted with this variegated, striated sense of community. And right now, we're seeing people move beyond those barriers all the time, and helping elders do their shopping, and the countless aspects of face-to-face contact that are taking place.
Yes, and that sense that actually your local high street is the sort of lifeblood of your entire universe. I mean, our universes right now have obviously shrunk, and in a way that is exact sort of thread of what goes through the novel, that the whole world is really concentrated, even though these people have come from everywhere. They've essentially all now, their world consists around one restaurant or one shop, one tube line. You know, Shan's daily life is essentially getting on. And the repetition in the novel is so beautifully done. He sees the same kid going to school every morning as he sets off to go to work. And that whole way in which we all do live that kind of routine life, but the way that that has come down to this one place, it's an incredibly sort of beautiful novel for this moment, I think. Well, I just want to end by saying thank you very much, and thank you to all the LRB listeners, and thanks, Nikita, for your wonderful book.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening. And just a reminder that you can order the book discussed in this episode by visiting lrb.me/order. That's lrb.me/order.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.